You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 15th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, author and journalist Nomi Prinz on her new book, All the President's Bankers: The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. Just in time for Tim Geithner's, I guess, is it a whitewash of his memoir? Also on the program today, Michael Boggs, looking less and less like this guy is going to make it out of committee. This is the supposedly Democratic judicial nominee in that deal with the two Republican senators from Georgia. More on that. Net neutrality vote today at the FCC. The proposals pass. They're simply now, I guess, legitimate proposals that will be commented on. It passes 3-2. We will have more on that. And a couple of people, I think, got arrested or at least pulled out of the hearing today. Harry Reid, not only did he come out strong against the Boggs nomination yesterday, which was a surprise, and I will tell you why later in the program, he's on the floor of the Senate today calling for a constitutional amendment to curtail money as speech. Protests erupting in Turkey, or planned, I should say, union strike over a horrible mine disaster. And meanwhile, in this country and around the world, fast food strikers are striking today. And the heartwarming story of our own Scotty B. Heading up to New Hampshire in time for the New Hampshire primary. He gets his buddies in the Senate to kill a three-year-in-the-making bipartisan deal to increase energy efficiency. You know, there's no... Well, we'll get into it, but...
Dudes. Dudes. Seriously.
There is no better argument as to the myth of the moderate Republican, you know, that supposedly, I'm thinking specifically, I think, you know, those two from Maine that are considered moderates. But, I mean, it just goes to show, when you vote for a supposed moderate Republican, you are simply enhancing the power of the lunatics. That's just the bottom line.
Dude.
And in L.A., apparently knee-deep in oil. But not the kind that you actually pull out of the ground on purpose, the kind that bubbles up because of a broken oil main. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Nomi Prinz.
I turn my camera on.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Nomi Prinz. She is an author, journalist, senior fellow at Demos. And her latest is All the President's Bankers, the Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. Welcome to the program, Nomi.
Oh, thanks so much, Sam.
Now, you know, I got to say, the book sort of goes from all the president's bankers to all the bankers' presidents in some way. You retell the history of the relationships between bankers and our presidents from nearly 110, 120 years in the making. Let's start in 1907, where, and give us a sense of what the relationship of bankers to the our government was at that time.
Well, to give you a sense, just a little bit before 1907, there were two recessions in the 1890s, and during those, the Treasury Department of the United States government had such a problem keeping track of its own finances that it had to borrow gold and borrow money from J.P. Morgan, who was the head of the Morgan Bank, which we know today is part of the J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, but at the time was the most powerful financier in the United States, and arguably in the history of the United States has continued to keep that realm. So by the time we got to 1907, there was a panic in New York City that was the result of rigging the markets, as many of them are, by a bunch of guys who decided they would buy up copper and make a lot of money and then just dump it on the rest of the market and not care. However, it went a little bit wrong. A crisis of confidence occurred, and all these people in New York were at the doors of the Knickerbocker Trust Company banks trying to get their money out. There was no FDIC insurance at the time. If you lost your money, if something was going belly up, that's it. You were had no recourse to getting your money out or back ever. And so what Teddy Roosevelt did at the time, and President Teddy Roosevelt, the Roosevelt family in general, had a strong relationship, a social relationship with the Morgan family. He contacted J.P. Morgan and said, you deal with this, take care of it, fix it. And what J.P. Morgan did at the time was he got $25 million from the Treasury Department, a little backup from the prior years where it had been going the other way around, to bail out whoever he wanted to bail out. What he didn't do was bail out the Knickerbocker Trust Company. The reason being he had no friends there, he had no relations there, he didn't care about it. What he did instead was take the $25 million from the Treasury Department, as well as ask some of his colleagues and friends that ran some of the big companies, the big banks at the time, to pony up money to save his interest, for example, the Trust Company of America and other trust companies at the time. So this was the first instance of a trust that was shown in a policy decision from respect to the President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt, to this private individual, this banker, J.P. Morgan, to fix a potential economic crisis. And in his memoirs later, Roosevelt characterizes that crisis as it could have been a bigger catastrophe. He uses the word catastrophe had J.P. Morgan not stepped in. Now, of course, J.P. Morgan used none of his own money to fix the markets at all. He used Treasury money and he used his friend's money, but he got the banner in the press and in the White House of having been the savior.
And of course, there's a lot of, I mean, it's amazing in some respects how little has changed in 101 years later in 2008. But let's stay in the early 20th century. One of the things that you point out is that the relation, I mean, this is very much obviously about the relationship between those in power and the bankers. And you make the point that Teddy Roosevelt came in as a trust buster, but one of the trusts that he did not bust was the banking trust, if you will.
Well, exactly. Part of it was because of his personal trust, as this went into the relationship aspect these men had and that their families had and that they had before that and afterwards. He decided not to touch the banks. He did touch some of J.P. Morgan's other interests, for example, in steel. He touched the Standard Oil Company, the Rockefeller family interests, but he didn't touch the money interests, these money trusts, as they were called at the time. It was something that he left out. And all of the decades afterwards, this was a precedent, because a few years later, when Woodrow Wilson had the potential to strengthen antitrust laws that had been established in the 1890s for the sake of reducing the monopoly and the power of certain trusts, certain industries, countries, he didn't touch banking either. And part of the reason he didn't touch banking either was because Jack Morgan, now the son of J.P. Morgan, was going to finance World War One, and chose to tell Wilson that that would be much easier if Wilson could make sure that Congress didn't impinge upon his bank's right to expand and do whatever they were going to do.
So, I mean, there's, you know, and I can't help but you know, and I want to sort of save this for a little bit later in our conversation, but you know, in Geithner's, one of the quotes I've seen from Geithner's book, I haven't read it yet, but one of the quotes I've seen is him talking about having only dealt with the sort of the upper echelon of the bankers and finding them all to be competent people and people essentially that he could trust. And that was sort of the dynamic that existed then. But there was a much more, I mean, the president seemed to have had more power. In other words, he was bending the bankers more often than not. And I don't just mean a specific president, but for at least the first three quarters, I guess, of the 20th century, the bankers were doing as much of the government's bidding as vice versa. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it's very true. There was a lot of the symbiotic collaboration between the men in Washington, the men that ran the White House and the Treasury Department, and the bankers. And this was one of the collaboration in terms of policy, which it also was. These men hung out together. They yachted together. They discussed things socially. The Morgans and the Rockefellers created a club in New York called the Metropolitan Club in the early 1900s, where all the elite individuals in finance and industry and politics would get together and discuss matters of the day. So there was a lot of that continued through much of the, you know, two-thirds to three-quarters of the 20th century. And largely that was because the biggest banking institutions, in particular Chase, National City Bank and First National Bank, which we know today as the part of the conglomerate Citigroup, and the Morgan Bank and their constituent banks, Morgan Guaranty and Morgan Stanley, and different banks there, or a component of the families of and the individuals in the different components of the family of Morgans, they all knew each other and they all had an open access to each other. David Rockefeller, for example, in the 60s, had known at that point JFK for two decades, actually three decades. They met in 1938 at a party in London that then his father, Joe Kennedy, had thrown for Kathleen Kennedy, JF Kennedy's sister, at which David Rockefeller was present in the 30s. And then, of course, David Rockefeller became head of the Chase Constellation in the 60s and 70s and into the early 80s. So there was these associations that were established at the level of family and legacy and blood and social connections, impacted policies as well. They impacted financing for World War One and World War Two. They impacted which side the U.S. would be on in those wars. They impacted where the U.S. expanded under Truman and largely under Eisenhower during the Cold War, because the U.S. expanded internationally as a global superpower along the lines that these bankers expanded their own interests and their own institutions internationally. So the collaboration was in terms of foreign policy, military policy, and financial and economic policy. But there was also an accountability that was required, particularly from the 30s, from the Great Depression and FDR, through really LBJ in the late 60s, which was that bankers had to also be accountable to the national interest, to the public good. If there were policies that presidents were trying to press through, whether that was under Eisenhower building the highways or whether that was under LBJ creating the Great Society and some of the programs he put in from a progressive nature, they required their friends, these people they had known for decades in the banking community, to support their policies, in return for which they put U.S. government might behind the bankers' expansion. That all started to fall apart from the 80s on, from really the end of Carter through Reagan, through Bush, through Clinton, through Bush, through Obama, and probably through Bush or Clinton or whoever becomes president next.
All right, so let's go back. I mean, is there a sense in, I mean, you've obviously done exhaustive research here. I don't want this to sound conspiratorial, but and I don't mean it in that way at all. But how much did it help, let's say, Jack Kennedy? I mean, it's not just a coincidence that he has these relationships. During that part of the country's history, did you need to have those type of relationships to become president? In other words, you know, Would Jack Kennedy have ever been president had he not had these type of relationships?
Well, in JFK's case, a lot of that hinges back to his father, Joe Kennedy, because Joe Kennedy, in addition to doing a lot of rather questionable activities on the financial side when he was in the sort of bootlegging industry and then later on in Hollywood and so forth, he basically backed FDR. He backed Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1932 election, and he did it very aggressively. He was key, because he was developing businesses in Hollywood, he was key in getting California's vote to come in behind FDR during that election, which was a lot of what swung that election. FDR had ran as vice president a couple terms before that and had lost as part of that ticket. So Joe Kennedy was part of the resurrection, and the relationship between the Kennedys and the Roosevelts was very important. So FDR turned around in 1934 as a thank you to Joe Kennedy, said, you can be head of the new SEC. So in the way of this thank you policy, this you give me this, you give me help, I will give you help, he appointed Joe Kennedy head of SEC. This gave Joe Kennedy not just the financial legacy that he had, but also much more the political grasp within the Roosevelt administration and the administrations that followed. So when Jack Kennedy became, when JFK became a senator and so forth, that was all part of this political financial alliance, this legacy between these individuals that, yes, helped him along the way. And it didn't hurt that he was articulate and good-looking and young, and
right,
that was part
right.
of where the 60s were going and everything else. But definitely behind the scenes that helped. In Kennedy's case, it's very interesting because he's one of the few presidents, along with Nixon, so that's where they're similar, that had very adversarial relationships with the bankers once they were in office and very much were their own men and didn't sort of coddle them the way that other administrations before that and the way that LBJ in between had done.
Yeah, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but I mean that similarity is interesting because on one level Nixon was not of those people, right? I mean,
right.
Kennedy was part of, you know, an aristocracy in some respects.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if they get to that sort of similar place, but from a different dynamic that, you know, Kennedy can require of his fellow aristocrats, as it were, because there is some notion still of like, maybe I'm just projecting here, but that you do ultimately have a little bit of a duty to your country. That's the way it's going to work. Here's my project. That's your project. We're going to help each other out. And his expectations may have been higher because he was of that group, whereas Nixon's seemed to come from an animosity because he wasn't of that group.
Yeah, and that's why that period in time was so fascinating. For one hand, that Kennedy had this sort of establishment types of relationships that should have been held accountable during his administration, but at the same time, his personal style, and a lot of the photos I actually examined at the time, it's interesting because, you know, we know of him as romantic and dashing and all that kind of, and, you know, through social, that digging into the photos of him with a number of the head bankers at the time, even people like John McCoy, who had ran Chase at one point under the Rockefeller it's their family mentorship program. He also has these photos where they just look uncomfortable standing next to each other. So there was something in the personal psyche relative to the financial community that's sort of apparent in some of the documents as well as some of the photos of Kennedy with the key bankers at that time. And I think one of the main things, and this is just one of many of them, I'm so glad you're asking, there's so much of this sort of richness and texture in the book outside of the main themes that Rockefeller and Kennedy just seem to have an adversarial personal relationship. Rockefeller had been expanding himself into Washington, and after Kennedy expanded even more so in terms of Washington influence. And I think there was just something there between those men that somehow didn't work in terms of requesting accountability to Rockefeller from Kennedy. And there was a Life magazine article that was quite fascinating in mid-1962, where Rockefeller and Kennedy had these letters between each other and Rockefeller's policies that were actually quite critical, whereas Kennedy's response to the level, as well as from the same type of family hierarchies.
And so let's go back and pull out. Explain to us, you know, starting in World War One, how the bankers not just sort of facilitated our foreign policy, but shaped it in what ways?
This goes back to the relationship of Jack Morgan with Woodrow Wilson. Now, Woodrow Wilson, when he came into office, he had earlier been the president of Princeton University. He had been a politician growing from the outside of the establishment, but at the same time, he required the establishment to get him to where he was politically, and he was associated with the Morgan family for a decade and a half before he became president in terms of supporting him. So when it came time for World War One to begin, Jack Morgan, who was very much on the side of the Allies, very much on the side of Britain and France because of past Morgan relationships on a personal and professional level with banks in Britain and France, pushed Wilson in a lot of manners to get off of his initial position of neutrality in the war because of Morgan's position of supporting the Allies. And in addition to that, he worked very closely, and there's a lot of documents that I examined to this effect, he worked very closely with the Treasury and the State Department on the financing of World War One, because at the time there wasn't this notion of putting so much debt out through the Treasury Department. Debt had to be raised through individuals and also on a private basis. And it turned out that the Morgan Bank wound up privately financing or facilitating the private financing for war efforts to the tune of 75% of all the war financing into World War One. So a substantive number is reported and discussed within the White House and within the executive offices. So without that, it would have been more difficult to raise money for war to be in the war, and it certainly pushed Wilson because of his relationships and his trust of that family and their collaborators to take a side earlier than perhaps the U.S. would have in the war.
And there was also sort of a simultaneous, I mean, a battle almost between bankers in some respects, because there were banking relationships with the Axis powers. I mean, those with the Germans, I guess, and so it's really just whose buddies went out at that point or what?
Yeah, the National City Bank was the bank that was sort of deciding who to be associated with. Now, one of the heads of National City Bank, James Stillman, and the Stillman family was very tight with the Morgans. Part of why James Stillman became such a powerful financier was because of his relationship with J.P. Morgan. So on the one hand, he wanted to go with them, and on the other hand, there was a sort of more upstarty guy outside of the establishment, but rising, named Frank Vanderlip, who very much just wanted to make money and was of the idea that we shouldn't necessarily just support Britain, we should be supporting any side. So he was more in that neutrality position, and of course Wilson went off into the Allied position, and so there were a lot of infights between National City Bank and the Morgan Bank at the time. And when James Stillman wound up dying in the middle of the war, he died in 1918, so towards the end of the war, Frank Vanderslip and his group tried to finance more of the Axis side, but then James Stillman's son decided to go the other way. So there was still this back and forth within the institution. By the time we got to the Second World War, though, there was a lot more of an idea that there could be funding of both sides of the war. There at that point had been more relationships established, for example, with Germany and Italy on the financing side in the wake of World War One, and in particular the Chase Bank was really on both sides of the war, but also managed to capitalize on the Second War with respect to selling bonds, war bonds, into the public, as did National City Bank at the time. So in addition to figuring out who to support in terms of the different nations on the war, they were also accumulating capital and deposits from individuals throughout the country in a tight process-type project with the Treasury Department to say to individuals, look, you buy war bonds, that's patriotic, that's how we need to finance the war. And by the way, you can also open an account at National City Bank or at Chase, so we'll help you out after the war. And as a result, these two banks gained in supremacy relative to the Morgan Bank in the wake of World War II and became preeminent in terms of the political financial policy impact after that, because they all of a sudden had all this extra capital because they went into the population to extend their services in return for also providing them with war bonds, which helped the country. And then as a separate tangent to that, the Treasury Department paid a lot of fees to these banks to distribute war bonds. So they made money off of the war bonds in a different way as well. But they still thought of it as their patriotic duty. It just happened to make them a lot of money, too.
Right. I mean, that's really, in many respects, the story of those years, is that aligned interests at some level, and which one fact which I wasn't aware of was when Glass-Steagall, I mean, moving ahead a little bit, or I guess a little bit back, at least in terms of, into domestic policy, Glass-Steagall was not as, I guess, universally, it was supported by the bankers, right? I mean, tell us about that, because I found that somewhat surprising.
I was surprised as well. I mean, I've been writing about Glass-Steagall and it being just a sort of populist stance of FDR for 10 years or more. And when I went back to the archives of Roosevelt in Hyde Park and examined his, you know, documents and connections and letters and so forth with the key bankers of the time, I discovered that it was really Winthrop Aldrich, who was the head of Chase at the time that FDR was elected and through his administration, who was promoting a stricter version of Glass-Steagall. In other words, a stricter regulation that would separate the speculative activities of banks from depositors, or from the potential of the government to have to, not at the time there weren't bailouts, but to take on its chin the economic deterioration that could happen and as a result of a crash, as a result of the crash in 1929. So Aldrich was really FDR's right-hand person within Washington, because Carter Glass at the time was friends with the Morgans, and the Morgan Bank didn't want Glass-Steagall. And even though Roosevelt was also friends with the Morgans, he took a stand. And he also realized politically that he had these two other banks. He had Winthrop Aldrich running Chase and also James Perkins, who was now running National City Bank, two of the other big banks, on his side in terms of separating these banks. And he believed, and they believed, that to detach the betting side from the money side, from the individual deposit side and institutions, would create more confidence in the banking system throughout the country. So in a way, FDR was trying to put banking back together, and these bankers were helping him to do that. And Winthrop Aldrich fought with Carter Glass to make this Glass-Steagall Act hold for the private bank, which was the Morgan Bank. Carter Glass didn't want to include that bank or banks like it. And so in a way, on the one side, it was competitive, because Aldrich knew that he would keep the deposit side and he was fine. In fact, he spun off the trading side, the speculative side, before Glass-Steagall was passed, as did James Perkins. He told his shareholders at National City Bank, we are separating. And this was before the act passed, which was a few months later. The act passed in June of 1933. This was right from the get-go. This was in March of 1933. And FDR, as a thank you for that, also wound up supporting these men's institutions more, and they wound up supporting him through his administration more, with a couple of disagreements along the way. But it was a really interesting incident of Roosevelt going against one set of friends and using his other friends who were on his side to get this type of legislation passed. And now when I think of Glass-Steagall, not only do I think of it as legislation, I think of it as something much more than that. I think of it as a real statement of political financial policy, and what's important from the standpoint of reducing risk in the overall economy relative to what bad speculation can do to the country. And so it was much bigger than one act. Now that I see all of how the players involved operated and what it was really designed to do.
Well, I mean, was Aldrich working out of just some greater sense of responsibility? I mean, obviously he thought he could find he would still he would curry favor, and he would still obviously find success just as simply as a commercial bank. But did he represent a perspective on his occupation that somehow changed in the late 70s, I guess, mid 70s, 80s? I mean, talk about that, because that seems to be sort of the before and after shot.
Yeah, I think he did. I think these men, first of all, they came from very wealthy families, or they married into very wealthy families. So it wasn't a question of merely getting richer or merely expanding their institutions, which they're also competitive and also wanted to do. They did, and in a lot of the letters between them, and these are personal, non-public matters, they really do talk about what they believe to be best for the country as well as best for themselves. They're actually quite open about both sides of that. They're quite open about, Winthrop Aldrich is quite open about what he needed to do for the country. He believed that the war bond effort was important in order to position the U.S., as victorious in World War II and so forth, but he also saw that as an opportunity to grow his own bank. So he was really able to do both. And a fellow named Tom Lamont, going back to the First World War with Woodrow Wilson, he actually supported Woodrow Wilson's notion of the League of Nations, which would have been the precursor at the time to the United Nations, so that there would be more peace in the world in the wake of World War I. That League of Nations was not passed by Congress. They became more isolationist after World War I. But Lamont at the time, who was a Republican banker, went on the side of a Democrat president because he believed that this was important. So there was more of a notion of trying to see the greater picture as well as balancing it with their own aspirations, which was perhaps indicative of the time, perhaps indicative of these particular men, perhaps indicative of the accountability that the relationships required from them and their accountability to the president. And there was a lot less people in between. There was a lobbyist and lawyers and all sorts of people in between doing a lot of this. This was very direct, and so the accountability was very direct, and their decisions were very direct. And it's not to say that they didn't do things that turned out to be negative and or self-serving,
right.
But it's to say that they really had a much stronger ability to see the very picture. I mean, a lot of these guys would leave their positions and do food drives out in Europe in the wakes of both wars. You know, they would leave the sort of status and the comfort of New York City to get on boats to go into areas where there was famine and starvation. Part of that was to assess it for restructuring and financing, but part of it was also to help.
I mean, is it, because I want to jump up to the 70s and 80s when this starts to turn, where there seems to be, assuming a certain level of course, a desire to gain profits and doing things that weren't always necessarily that worked out. But the idea, the civic mindedness or where these bankers perceive themselves in the broader context of society, that they actually had some type of responsibility, not just to maximize their profits, but also to do well by something outside of that, you know, whether or not I would even agree with how they perceive that. That seems to change in the 70s and 80s. Talk about how that happens, how this dynamic shifts, where presidents aren't, not only are not holding the bankers accountable, it's almost like the bankers are holding the presidents accountable.
Yeah, or hostage. I mean, to a large extent, a couple of things happened in the 70s. One was we went off the gold standard, and that was largely because the bankers, and this was mostly Walter Wriston, who was rising in National City Bank, and David Rockefeller at Chase. So there's really two main men, and then there was others from other banks that were driving a lot of this new shift in policy and accountability and more being pushy to the president as opposed to being collaborators. They decided that, you know, if we didn't have gold, if we didn't have, if banks didn't have the necessity of reserving some asset or something against the transactions they were doing, they could do more transactions, which remains true to this day. So on the one hand, there was the beginning of providing bankers the ability to really do more in terms of financing in the world and transactions and deals and trading in the world because they had less asset-related accountability, and that happened in the beginning of Nixon's term. And also then they found oil. They went to expand in particular. This was under Chase and the Rockefeller family, as well as John McCloy, who became a lawyer for the Seven Sisters Oil Company. So there's this combination of oil and financial interests that were expanding into the Middle East. And with the price spikes, the oil price spikes that happened in the 70s, that was obviously very detrimental to the U.S. population. We remember the long, or through pictures or whatever, the long lines and the real pain that occurred in the U.S. and in other countries because of that, but the bankers made tons of money out of that. So this was the way to say, you know what, we don't care what's going on in the United States, we don't care about these lines. We have all this unlimited almost profit potential out here by recycling a lot of the petrodollars and profits that were coming out of the Middle East into the form of debt and other things into Latin America, where they had wanted to expand in other places. So they became detached from the idea of solving problems on a national level and just became more international and more global, and that detached them from accountability. And nor did they, nor was it demanded of them, and nor did they provide it. And then when we got to Reagan, all of this sort of fell apart because the loans that had been extended in massive billions of dollar amounts to the third world started to implode. They couldn't afford them. And that was the time where bailouts really began to happen in force, and bankers really started to hold Washington accountable. And not they were still not separate from Washington. They were still bankers as part of Washington. Ronald Reagan's first Treasury Secretary was the former CEO of Merrill Lynch, Don Regan. So there was certainly a lot of connections, but the philosophy changed, and even the individuals in Washington were held hostage to this idea of, if we don't bail these banks out, if we don't find a way to push the World Bank or the IMF to fund these loans so that these countries can pay back the private loans to the banks, then everything's going to fall apart. We're going to have this catastrophe. And that's what happened. That's when policy started pushing as well. And bankers thought, you know what, this is great. We can bet. We can recycle all this money. And if we have a problem, we'll just go to the Treasury Department or straight to the White House and it'll get solved. And that began to happen through the 90s and the Mexican peso crisis, the Asian crisis, through the subprime crisis of more recent years. And the individuals within Washington or running the banks collaborated on all of this. Washington became just the backstop for bad practices and reckless endangerment of the national population as well as the international population.
This is basically the story of how banks went from, I guess, being a tool of American, I guess, policy, foreign and domestic, to almost the American government being a tool of banks.
Right, and the philosophy of the government in the process changing as well. So yes, that's one of the outside conclusions, but the relationships between the men running the White House Treasury Department and so forth, and the men running the largest, the big six banks of any generation, those relationships continue to exist, but the demand, yes, from the government of the bankers, or the desire of the bankers to not just profit for themselves but do something in the greater picture, completely altered as well more recently. So now we have no accountability of the bankers. They're still involved in Washington. You know, we still have our last couple of Treasury secretaries, give or take a few, come from being lead positions on Wall Street, or if not lead positions on Wall Street, lead positions at the New York Fed, and then, you know, in sort of guise of Tim Geithner, and who had, therefore, big relationships with the heads of Wall Street firms and so forth. And they're what's driving the policies that we have. They're what's driving all of it right now.
I mean, is this a part of like a broader societal change? I mean, it's not, my sense of like, it's a Tim Geithner is not just that he wants to help his friends. It's that this is his, they've adopted a different worldview than it existed at the time, it's the banks over everything else, that nothing, it's almost like the oxygen that we need. If it's bad for the banks, it's necessarily bad for everything else.
Well, that's the thing. Before, when we talked about the panic of 07, this was a situation where banks had caused a problem, and a banker was asked by President Roosevelt to help the situation and given money in order to do that. So some of that was in past history, and then in the 30s through the 70s, it really changed into sort of more of a unified approach to a policy that helped national as well as expansion of international interest. And now, yes, it's really the worldview changed in the 70s. It also, this idea of American competitiveness, though, that the philosophy that Tim Geithner has, that Don Regan had, that Nicholas Brady, who was Bush's Treasury Secretary, had, that Hank Paulson had under Bush, the other Bush, and that Robert Rubin had under Clinton. All of these men have said the same thing to get the same result. And what they said was, in order for America to remain competitive, having built, you know, this is their argument. This is just what they said in Congress, at the White House, in documents and so forth. In order for America to remain competitive, its financial system needs to remain competitive. And in order for its financial system to remain competitive, it needs to be free. And this was a philosophy that was embraced on the Republican side, the Democrat side. It didn't matter. It was a philosophy that suited the banks because they have only grown more consolidated in terms of their control of wealth, of capital, of assets, and of policy in the last several decades than they had been before that, and they continue to do so. So in the wake of the 2008 crisis, whatever Tim Geithner says or doesn't say, whether he helped this, of course he helped his friends. His friends are all doing much better now, and his friends' institutions are doing much better now, and even the friends that aren't running those institutions anymore are doing quite fine. So he definitely used that philosophy or embraced that philosophy to help his friends. And that philosophy did not help the greater American public or the greater international public.
Do you have a sense of how they perceive the banks and sort of the ever increasing financialization of our economy? I mean, there when we talk about the banks in the early 1900s. In the first half of the 19th, the 20th century, we're talking about banks also sort of driving the engine of an industrial economy. And now it just seems, and not just seems, I mean, I think there's plenty of empirical evidence that they're simply driving the engine of just greater financialization, that the money is just an ends and a means in and of itself. I mean, is this for them just like this is the cost of growth?
Yeah, no, this is absolutely the money for the sake of money has been to some extent present since this financialization began in the early 1900s. What's happened in the recent decades, and particularly now, it's just increased to such a massive amount that it clouds out any other potential use for money. So every deal that the largest institutions make is all about trying to extract the most amount of profit and not necessarily to have the best result from the standpoint of that company or that project or whatever it might be. It's all about really how you screw your clients, whoever they may be, in order to make the most amount of money. And oftentimes they're not even real clients because there's also this idea of financialization of the securities and the derivatives market and all of that itself, which enables banks to say they're making markets, but in fact they're just trading positions around, so they're just making money, out of volume, out of going in and out of countries, of securities, of creating complex securities to do the same things from which they can extract more profit. And all of this continues to increase in complexity, and it gives them more power even than they have. The big six banks today control 84% of all the insured deposits in the country. They've never had so much power. They control 96% of all of the derivatives transactions that happen in this country, and 45% of all of the derivatives transactions in the world. That's just six banks. So the amount of power they have over money, over capital, over leveraged capital, over all the crazy toxic securities and all sorts of convoluted transactions that come out of that is more epic than it's ever been before.
Do you think that in the absence of sort of these personal relationships, I mean, obviously now President Obama, you know, has these personal relationships, but he doesn't come from the same sort of, I guess, social strata that the bankers have come from in many respects. I mean, I guess, you know, he did go to Harvard, I guess, but he's not of this ilk, I guess. And has the loss of those sort of ability to sort of hold these people personally accountable, and it sort of just replaced with this sort of cognitive capture on some level? I mean, is it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and it's I do explore it in different ways. Obama, and one of the things I say about these relationships, these families and so forth, is that every so often there is a protege that, like, pops into the equation. It was Tom Lamont back for the Morgans. You know, it's Obama kind of for the establishment, really, of Goldman Sachs, because all of Obama's cabinet, from the standpoint, or many of them from the economic and treasury standpoint, came from the Clinton administration, and Clinton gained his legitimacy on Wall Street through his connections to Goldman and their connections to their clients, which was how much of his campaign was financed. Of course, Goldman was one of the two top contributors in Obama's initial campaign and so forth. So every so often in this, there's this shift in sort of families of power to extend it to, you know, an outsider. And to some extent, you know, Obama was, I think, the recipient of some of that, you know, in the right place in the right time. And yes, he went to Harvard, like 9 of the last 19 presidents went to, and that helped. But, you know, there was also a lot of that. But then LBJ didn't come into any of that. I'm going backwards in history, because that's when we had some accountability on both sides. You know, he wheeled and dealed in Texas, and he certainly knew how to speak the language of business, but he was definitely not an Eastern establishment banking type. And yet he was able to create relationships and political requirements from these individuals very quickly. A lot of that since he had been in Washington a long time, whereas President Obama was in Washington for, like, you know,
right,
less than 2 years. So there were reasons for some of that, but there was also more of a drive to do that, and maybe also the ability to do that. In Obama's case, a lot of the policies have been in place before he came into office, but he also didn't do anything to change any of them with respect to concentrating the wealth and influence of the bankers. Instead, you know, it was noted in the beginning of his term, aside from who financed him, that Jamie Dimon was his favorite banker. If you look at the annual tax returns of the Obama family, their personal money, their assets, are with J.P. Morgan Chase Asset Management. So there has been a relationship developed, but the accountability of that relationship has not also developed.
And so, I mean, ultimately, the solution is going to be one that is sort of an institutional accountability that I gather Dodd-Frank is nowhere up to the task in terms of. It may have patched up a couple of holes here or there, but the boat, as it were, is just as susceptible to sinking. What do you say when people say that Glass-Steagall wouldn't have prevented this? That if we go back, because I know that you've promoted the idea of returning to a sort of a Glass-Steagall type of a broader regime. What is your response to something like that?
Well, my initial response is you should read my book. Because you have to, one has to understand the history of Glass-Steagall. And as I said earlier in speaking with you, Tim, Glass-Steagall wasn't just an act. Glass-Steagall was a political financial policy. It was a decision as to how American money, economics, finance, and politics would work going forward. It was much more than a piece of paper. It was much more than a lot of acts in that respect. To say that, if we had had it, if we hadn't have had it, or if we had it, just this crisis would have happened or not would have happened, neglects looking at that history. The result of decimating Glass-Steagall in pieces over the decades, with along up to the culmination of the full repeal of Glass-Steagall by the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act in 1999, has been a series of gives to a financial institution and structure that has, in return for what it's received from policy, taken more than it's given back.
Right.
So the result of expanding over state lines, the result of international expansion without additional accountability for what was going on back home, all of these things that bankers were doing and winning along the path of decimating the concept, the philosophy of Glass-Steagall as well as the legislation, resulted in different crises and different bailouts and different sets of pain for greater populations along the way. So, yes, if that hadn't happened, we might have had a more stable growth economically and financially than we've seen. There wouldn't have been these ups and downs and these requirements of Treasury secretaries to get in front of Congress and talk about catastrophe. And in talking about catastrophe, we received more money or more support from the Fed or the Treasury Department or just from government policy of the concentration of wealth and power and influence in these institutions. So, yes, if you had separated all of these activities to begin with, they would not have gotten as concentrated. The number of mergers in the banking industry would not have reached such a height, such that these banks controlled so much capital and so much risk in the country if you had had it. So, there's much larger conversations about Glass-Steagall. For example, people like Andrew Ross Sorkin at the Times talked about how banks that were in the eye of the storm in the last crisis, Lehman, Bear, et cetera, they weren't commercial banks. They weren't Glass-Steagall banks. But that also misses the notion of what happened because Glass-Steagall was repealed, and what happened because Glass-Steagall was repealed after 1999 is the big commercial banks started to get into investment banking. And as a counter to that, the investment banks requested more leverage or less rules from the SEC and got them. So the entire structure of the financial industry, whether it was because banks were taking their loans, securitizing them, and distributing them off of their own balance sheets, or whether they were leveraging them off the investment banking facilities, the investment banking firms, was still both a direct result from Glass-Steagall being repealed.
And we should just remind people that the implications of this is we have seen in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, which is just the human misery and suffering of millions of people who lost their jobs, whose lives in many respects will never recover from what that financial crisis the havoc it caused in our country, and we could very well be heading to another. Nomi Prinz, the book is All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. It's a fascinating read. We'll link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much, Nomi, for joining us.
Thanks so much, Sam.
All right, folks, we got to take a break, and we're going to head into the fun half of the program, where we'll hear the... we got this. Alex Jones has found the key to male virility, and folks,
sounds like a product you should look into.
Excuse me. Oh, vitality, and I should say not male vitality, but super male vitality. And of course, it would be irresponsible of me not to share it with you, which we will do in the funner half of the program. The story of these relationships is fascinating, and it's for the life of me I cannot remember. But this idea that this relationship between he had an interview a couple of weeks ago where we have the sort of the shell of this dynamic between these presidents and these bankers, and these relationships which, in and of themselves, I mean, are, you know, anti-democratic in many respects, but where you had both parties, at least, with aligned incentives that had to do with what was best for the country, and that has gotten completely out of whack. So you still have the shell of those relationships, but they end up creating a much worse outcomes.
I have some good news. We're gonna have to get to it during the better. I think we definitely have to get to it during the better half.
Do tell.
Our good friend Chief Kessler is back with another video.
Oh, fantastic! Chief Kessler from Pennsylvania, you'll recall, the one who would shoot at a mound of dirt and yell things like "Libtards, come and get it!"
And it's too early to say this, but my favorite of his was, you.
Yes. You really enjoyed it when he swore.
It was great.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will get to that in the funner half. Also, the results of this net neutrality vote, what it means going forward, and the Michael Boggs nomination, what his chances of going forward are. Harry Reid hitting to the floor of the Senate and calling for an amendment to essentially curtail money's equation with speech. And are we going to see any major movement on that front? No, but I will talk about why I think it's still such a valuable thing that the Senate Majority Leader is talking that way. Speaking of talkers, Rush Limbaugh. Man,
talking into a void.
Apparently. I wonder if we have the same size audience as Limbaugh does in Los Angeles now. I bet maybe it's, I don't know. And then, of course, a report on Scotty B. Wow, we are jam-packed going in.
We got to get to Scotty B.
Of course. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be a part of the program, you can IM me at Majority FM. Folks, it is your support of this program that keeps it alive, period. End of story. End of story, end of paragraph, end of sentence. If you have the financial means, please support this program. 33 cents a day. Please don't make us sell Super Male Vitality. Don't make us make those videos. Although, if you, maybe we should auction off. You know, we should do like a fundraiser. We will make a Super Male Vitality video and get on Indiegogo. We just want to.
Sam, this is completely spontaneous. We're talking about this.
I just want to say, Michael and Matt.
No one knows what we're talking about yet.
I know. Okay.
It's foreshadowing.
We got to get to it.
Calm yourself.
All right. You can also support, so you can become a member today by just simply going to majority.fm and become a member. You can support this program by buying your Amazon crap through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Give us a review on iTunes. Pick up the app at majority app. It's majorityapp.com. It's totally free. You can listen live to the show, iOS and Android. You can, as even as a freebie, you can get the last, I think, 20, 30 shows. As a member, you can log in. You obviously get the extra 50 minutes a day. You can log in on the app, but you get literally streaming access. Or if you want to download, you have the choice. You can just stream it. If you think you're going to go into a subway or into onto an airplane without internets, you can download it. But you get access to the like every show we've done over the past 3 years, which is, I think, like, is it 1,000 shows? We're pretty close, right? I think around 850, 900 shows, and it's searchable. So you want to find out. How many times, I mean, we've had Mark Maron on, or if you're looking for that interview we did with Paul Pearson about his book, or whoever it is, you simply search it. It's fully searchable. Everyone should have the app. Incidentally, we're over 5,000 people who have downloaded the app now. I don't know how it breaks down iOS or Android, but over 5,000 people. So... But that means that there's thousands more who have not gotten the app. We'll be right back. 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM.
Set an apple pen.